The names Paul Nitze and George Kennan will be familiar to most American history buffs, but few may be aware of just how important a role they played as philosophical opponents during the Cold War era. Also surprising is, despite their vastly different views on how the United States diplomacy should be conducted, the two maintained a lifelong friendship. Nicholas Thompson, Paul Nitze's grandson, gained access to his grandfather's personal papers and letters, and now he's written a book called The Hawk and the Dove, Paul Nitze, George Kennan, and the History of the Cold War. It's published by Henry Holt. I'm very pleased it has brought Mr. Thompson, who's an editor at Wired Magazine, to our show.
I'm very Welcome. Pleased to be here.
I imagine that most people think the lives of their grandparents are deserving of a book, but in your case, few would argue with you. When did you first decide you wanted to write about your grandfather?
The seed was planted in 1999. I was a young journalist in Washington, and I went to my grandfather's house for dinner one night. And after dinner and drinking a glass of wine, he read a letter. And earlier that week, he had published an op-ed in the New York Times saying we should get rid of all of our nuclear weapons. It was a very different position than my grandfather took through most of his life. And he received this lovely letter in response from George Kennan, and it said something like, "Dear Paul, I read your op-ed. I agree with every word. Isn't it nice that after 50 years of such disagreement, we finally find ourselves in complete accord?" I thought, what a wonderful letter. How interesting that someone would write this after a 50-year friendship. Then, 5 years later, they died soon after one another. Nitze died October 2004, Kennan April 2005. And I read Kennan's obituary and I thought, my gosh, these lives were very similar.
Well, before your grandfather died at the age of 97 in 2004, did he talk to you or your father about the role he'd played in the Cold War?
He talked to me a little bit about it, but by the time that I was old enough to ask him the right questions, he was too old to give me complicated answers.
Were you granted access to his personal papers and letters simply because he was your grandfather?
I think so. I certainly had access, of course, to the filing cabinets in his basement because I can go into his house and, you know, his wife gave me access to the papers. But there was another – the moment which was crucial to my reporting came one day when I went to the Paul Jensen School at SAIS. And I'd been looking at some papers on the sixth floor. And one Saturday, I walked in and said hello. And there's a janitor there, the only person in the building. And I said, I want to see the Nitze papers. I'm Nitze's grandson. He said, oh, you're Nitze's grandson. I'll show you the papers. He puts me in the elevator, presses four. I think, that's a little strange. We go down a hallway. He opens a door, and there's a big blue boiler. And behind the boiler are 60 boxes, which include everything from handwritten notes on the Cuban Missile Crisis to letters from my great-grandmother to my grandfather. So it was the janitor would not have brought anybody there.
Did you also have access to any of George Kennan's personal papers?
Yeah. Kennan's family, I think because of the closeness of the two men, gave me access to all of his diaries. So I actually probably had more documentation from Kennan's life just because Kennan kept such careful records.
As a child, how aware were you about what your grandfather's occupation was?
I knew what he did. I wrote a sixth grade term paper on ICBMs, and I was invited to the White House when I was in fourth grade. But it wasn't – what I mainly remember is being frustrated that I missed a soccer game. So it wasn't the it wasn't everything.
When did he begin working in government?
He began working in government in 1940.
So this is during World War II, but as we discussed earlier, Neil Sheehan and I, the Cold War was already starting somewhere in the middle of World War II.
Yeah, absolutely. My grandfather, well, George Kennan, of course, plays a crucial role in starting the Cold War, in a sense, in breaking our alliance with Moscow.
How many presidents did your grandfather work for?
He worked for everyone from Roosevelt to Bush, and he was fired or demoted by Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Ford, Carter, and Bush.
We're talking about the second Bush?
The first Bush.
And did he have a wide range of official titles?
Oh, absolutely. He ranged – his highest ranking position was probably Deputy Secretary of Defense. His most interesting position was probably Ronald Reagan's chief arms negotiator. He was head of the policy planning staff under Harry Truman.
You say he was the diligent insider and George Kennan was the wise outsider. But Kennan worked for many presidents too, didn't he?
Well, not as much. Kennan plays a crucial role under Harry Truman from 1945 to 1949. He's head of the State Department's policy planning staff. Nitze is actually his deputy. And he helps write the Marshall Plan, a lot of the important things in those years. He actually helps set up the covert wing of the CIA. That's George Kennan on the inside. But after that, he's pretty much on the outside. He serves briefly as ambassador to Moscow, but he gets fired. And he serves briefly as ambassador to Yugoslavia, but he sort of bombs out there. So it didn't really work for him inside of government. He wasn't good at that.
Did they meet when they were both working in the Truman administration?
That's when they became close friends. They actually met on a train in 1943. My grandfather's a social guy, saw Kennan in the dining car, sat down, and they started chatting.
Did they always differ on how to conduct our foreign policy? Because the way you're describing it, they were both Cold Warers, but in very different ways.
They were. They actually, some of the more interesting moments of the book are where they agree. I mean, of course they agree from 45 to 49. They work very closely on the Marshall Plan together. They work very closely on plans about the partition of Germany. So 45 to 49, they're quite close. Then they split on the question of whether we should build a hydrogen bomb. And on the issue of nuclear weapons, they always diverge. For 50 years, they're in complete disagreement. But on other issues, for example, how to conduct the Korean War, some of the policies during the Vietnam War, there are a lot of ways where there's interesting overlap in their views.
George Kennan has come to be known as the father of containment.
Yeah.
Did Paul Nitze also believe in containment?
Nitze would say, absolutely, and in fact, I understood it better than George did. I mean, Nitze's view is that Kennan came up with a crucial idea, but it wasn't practical. Nitze made it practical. So Kennan's initial notion is that we should contain the Soviet Union. If we just put them in a box and don't let them expand, eventually they'll collapse. Nitze said, that's a great idea, but we need to do this through weapons. Kennan said, no, we just need to do this politically. Nitze said, no, militarily.
Because Kennan believed the Cold War would have ended sooner had there not been militarization of the rivalry.
Right. At the end of the Cold War, people say, George Kennan, you predicted exactly how it would go. And he says, well, yes, but if you hadn't followed the advice of people like Nitze, it would have ended a lot earlier.
You say that each was profoundly right at some moments and profoundly wrong at others. Now, of course, right is a matter of one person's calculation rather than another. Is this according to your calculation?
According to my calculations, yes, but also according to recently released documents. So, for example, we now know what what the Soviet arsenal size was. We know how many weapons they had, and we can say, and we know some of what their intentions were. And I went to Moscow and I interviewed lots of former Soviet arms negotiators. So we know something about what they were intending. So we can say Paul Nitze was wrong in the 1970s, where he said their arsenal was this side and they wanted to do this.
My guest is Nicholas Thompson, who's written a book called The Hawk and the Dove, Paul Nitze, George Kennan, and the History of the Cold War, published by Henry Holt. We can probably say, based on this book, that The Hawk kind of describes Paul Nitze, but not always, and The Dove kind of describes George Kennan, but not
always. That's absolutely right. It's a title, but I say in the beginning that on social issues, Kennan isn't a dove, he's a pterodactyl.
And that's, why is that? Because
Kennan is very, very conservative on social issues. He believes, he's against racial integration. I mean, he does not think kindly of non-white people. I mean, he likes...
And non-Christians and also.
Non-Christians. I mean, he has very dark views about the fate of the rest of the world. He thinks Africa and Asia are basically culturally doomed. He thinks terrible things are happening in the United States. We should get rid of Florida and Texas and California, probably.
Were the liberals who thought he was a voice of reason aware of any of this?
To a small extent, but not really. I mean, part of it is you read the Long Telegram, and at the very end it says, well, what should we do? Well, the best way to contain the Soviet Union is to build strength at home and to be good to ourselves. And you read that, and pretty much anybody can project onto it what they want. And Kennan never really explained exactly what he meant, but you read his diaries and you read some of his later essays and you read about his desire for Vermont to become an independent state, and you realize that what he really was saying is, get rid of the Latin American fringe of America and then we'll be able to contain Russia. So liberals didn't see that side of George Kennan.
What did Paul Nitze's diaries reveal? Were there any big surprises?
No. I mean, my grandfather, unfortunately, for my sake, didn't keep detailed diaries. I mean, the most interesting things are the letters he wrote to his mothers, and they show a very insecure yet ambitious young man climbing through Washington.
Do you learn anything about the Cuban Missile Crisis? We were just talking about that with Neil Sheehan.
I did. I learned a lot of interesting things. My favorite, I mean, I have sort of notes from all these meetings that historians have never seen before. But one meeting that really stuck out of my mind is there's a lunch meeting between McNamara and Nitze, and they're talking about what to do, and it's the Wednesday in the middle of the crisis. And there's a note, and it has three options, one of which is provoke an attack. And it shows that Nitze and McNamara were deciding whether, wait a second, maybe we should somehow get the Cubans to shoot a plane down, and then maybe we can start the war and just get it over with.
This sounds pre-Gulf of Tonkin thinking.
Well, that's true.
And they were really looking to perhaps provoke a war?
One of them was. I don't know. I don't know whether it was McNamara or Nitze. I asked Harold Brown, who, of course, knew both men and worked very closely with them. He said, sounds like Nitze.
Now, how difficult was it to find people who even were there? Most of them have died by now, haven't
they? A lot of people died. It was very unfortunate. But I interviewed 150 people, many of whom worked closely with my grandfather or with George Kennan, more with my grandfather because he was so engaged in government. But one thing about my grandfather is that he worked very closely with young people. He took them seriously and he helped guide their careers. So, for example, in 1969, he starts a new organization, hires some interns. His interns are Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, Edward Luttwak, Peter Wilson. So you have four people who are still alive and very influential and young and willing to talk today.
And who are all very much hawks.
Are very much hawks, yeah. Well, so, Wilson, not so much anymore. But yeah, the other three are very important hawks through the next 30 years.
Joe Wilson, we know what happened there. But in fact, he was a victim of hawks. But for a long time, he was part of, in the same way that Daniel Ellsberg was a hawk when he started.
Well, and Richard Perle is the most interesting case, where Perle works closely with my grandfather. And they're close, working for Scoop Jackson, who you were talking about earlier on the program. They're close through the 70s. And then in the 1980s, Richard Perle is my grandfather's harshest enemy. And they fight viciously throughout the Reagan administration. And
over what?
Over whether we should make deals with the Soviets. My grandfather, Nitz's position was, yes, we should make these deals. And yes, if the Soviets are offering us something important, we should yield on missile defense. That's the crucial debate between Perle and Nitz at, for example, the Reykjavik arms talk, which are the climax of my grandfather's career. Nitz says, they're offering us great concessions. We can make some concessions on missile defense. Perle says, absolutely not. And it leads to the breakdown of the talks, and it's one of the most interesting moments of my grandfather's life. But this young man, Richard Perle, who my grandfather helped bring up through Washington, is the one who helps undermine him. But Perle, for example, sat with me for hours and hours and was a great help.
You also saw your grandfather's FBI file?
I did see my grandfather's FBI file.
Why was an FBI file kept on a man who was so obviously an insider politically?
Well, very interesting. My grandfather's uncle, so my great uncle was a saboteur for the German government during World War I and was the paymaster for the largest terrorist attack carried out on American soil prior to 9/11. So there's a very dark black sheep in my family. And so that is a tip-off. And then my grandfather's mother, German, it's Nitz, he's a German man, his parents came from Germany. The FBI followed my great-grandmother and believed that she was a Nazi sympathizer. And then my grandfather said some bizarre things about Hitler at a dinner party in 1940. So there was a real sense that, wait a second, this guy comes from a family with some dark German roots. Maybe he's actually not up to anything good. So they followed my grandmother. They intensively investigate my grandfather. They followed my great-grandmother. They intensively follow my grandfather. And there's a long FBI file about all this. And of course, he's cleared. And people say, no, this is ridiculous. He's completely pro-American. But this FBI file follows him throughout his career. It's actually requested in 1953 by Joe McCarthy. It comes up – another time it comes up is when he's nominated to be Secretary of the Navy in 1963. And the far right thinks, wait a second, this guy isn't trustworthy. They don't know quite how hawkish he is. And a young congressman by the name of Donald Rumsfeld decides he wants to try to do in Paul Nitz. So there's a lot of interesting twists and turns where people you think might be allies of Nitz are not.
Talk about dark family ties. You also were granted access to Joseph Stalin's daughter, Svetlana.
Well, I wasn't granted access to her. I found her. She, Kennan helped her defect in this country 42 years ago. And so I found her and I wrote her a letter and I said, I'm writing a book about George Kennan. And she doesn't talk to reporters, but because I wasn't asking about her or her father, she said, sure. And so we ended up exchanging 75 letters. We talked on the phone. I went out and saw her a few times. And she is incredibly smart. I mean, she has father issues. I mean, as you would imagine, somebody grows up the son of Joseph Stalin. She has some sort of dark parts of her personality, but she loved talking about Kennan, and she helped me understand Kennan in the 60s, 70s, and 80s in a way that few other people did.
In what way?
Well, she knows Kennan's insecurities. She knows where Kennan goes wrong. There's a letter that she wrote to Kennan that I reprinted in my book and from about 1976, and it says, you know, Dear George, I've got something I wanted to tell you, and it's that you're unhappy. And the reason you're unhappy is that you haven't done what you've wanted to do. You really should be a recluse who writes books about America. You shouldn't be constantly trying to get back into government. You shouldn't be seeking awards from historical societies. I showed this to Kennan's son-in-law, and he stopped. He read it. He waited for a minute. He said, oh, my God, that is one of the smartest things I've ever seen about George Kennan.
In a recent issue of Wired, you wrote about an actual doomsday machine that was built by the Soviets. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Well, while researching, trying to understand what Soviet intentions were in the 1980s, I was given some secret Defense Department documents, which led me down a trail, which led me to realize that the Soviet Union did build a doomsday machine. They built a device that would have allowed them to respond to an American nuclear attack, even if we had blown up the defense ministries and even if we had blown up the Kremlin. It was a semi-automatic system that would have checked for an American explosion, and if there had been one, and if it lost communication with Central Command, would have transferred authority to a lieutenant colonel deep in a bunker who then could have, you know, started the retaliation. This was something
similar to something we had in effect here.
A couple of differences. We had airborne command alert, which would have allowed us to respond to a Soviet strike. A couple of differences. The main one is that we told them about it. The Soviets didn't tell us about this device. In fact, I interviewed my grandfather's chief negotiating partner, this guy named Yuli Kivitsinsky. He didn't even know about it. The Soviet military didn't tell the Soviet civilian negotiators that they had built this.
Mm. So because they didn't want it to be negotiated out of existence.
maybe because they thought if America knew about it, America would destroy it. But also, as I go into the story in Wired, it was built as a method of self-deterrence, not to deter America.
Was he a supporter of the Minuteman ICBM approach that I talked about earlier, which really was designed as a preventive weapon rather than as a destructive weapon?
Yes, but not to the extent that Bernard Shriver was. My grandfather believed that you build up your force and you prepare as though a fight might really happen, and you really work out the game theory and the intricacies. Some people had the sense you build these massive weapons, then war won't happen. My grandfather thought you build up these massive weapons, and then you deal with all the contingencies, and you realize that they might attack in this way, and they might attack in that way. And war could very well happen. There very well could be a nuclear war. But
thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.